Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. I gotta tell you something, people. Back in the 80s, when we, me and my friends were looking for fashion, we looked at TV, and you know, a lot of us like the new wave bands, the guys from England we see in videos, and of course there's a Miami Vice, but then there was 21 Jump Street, and that was our age, and we loved it. And my guest was one of the stars of that. But a few weeks ago, I read an article about shows on Apple TV, and they talked about Dope Thief. So I say to Joanne, I go, let's start watching this show. And we put it on, and like, all of a sudden, I'm like, oh my God, it's Dustin Gwynn. And I had to reach out to him because I love the show. I live right outside Philly, but in New Jersey. They shot it in Philly. And my guest is Dustin Gwynn. How you doing, man?
I'm terrific. Thank you for having me. And terrific that you saw Dope Thief.
Yeah, well, you know, I was looking. We always look, me and my wife, we try to find shows to watch together. And we have different tastes. And I said, I'm definitely watching this. I said, you watch one episode with me. If you don't like it, I'm still going to watch it. And we put it on, and it's a really good show. It's gritty. It's got a great feel. And how did you get involved with that?
It's after 30-something years working as an actor, I got to say that's up there in terms of probably the top, you know, five best things I've ever got to do. My agent told me about it, you know, and he said, Ridley Scott is doing this thing called Dope Thief, and there's a character in there, and I'm like, great, you know, send me the script, the auditions, whatever, and you know, that's all I needed to hear was Ridley Scott, who I idolize as a filmmaker, and they said, well, you know, they want to meet you on a Zoom. So I met also Peter Craig, who was the showrunner. He wrote all of the 8 episodes. And so I met with him on a Zoom, and essentially, I didn't have to audition for it, which is amazing. And Peter was just so generous. And, you know, one of the first things he said to me was, I wrote a Vietnamese Tony Soprano. I said, say no more, you know, I'm on. It just sounded very, very intriguing. And that's how I got involved. I just couldn't believe, you know, my luck. Off I went to Philly and spent a lot of time there. And, I mean, some of the greatest people in front and behind the camera on this production. So, but that's how I got involved. And then my character just were just so refreshing, and it just kept developing. Originally, I was only signed up for up to episode 6, Steve. And then Peter just kind of retooled. You know, I think he was also rewriting as it went along, and retooled the ending and decided to keep my character and also turn it into a very pivotal aspect of the ending of the 8 episodes. That was kind of fell in my lap, if you will.
Well, what I like about it also is, you know, I grew up in a town called Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and I lived in L.A. for a long time. And when I noticed, when I left in L.A., when I would talk to people I went to high school, you know, when I left New Jersey and right near Philadelphia, there was drugs, but there wasn't that big drug trade. And now it's all over. And the guy you play, you know, there are people like that who have these big houses, who are the father with a few kids, which makes it great because, you know, you think you're not like a like Tony Soprano, they're all hanging out. But this year, you're a father with a wife and kids when they show you at the birthday party and the kids in the backyard. And I think that's what makes it so captivating, too, is because it's like you sit there and you go, and you always think this as a viewer, like, okay, this guy has a good side. I mean, yeah, he's slinging drugs, but he's a father. So as an actor, that must be great to bite your teeth into a role like that.
It truly is, because, you know, now that I'm a father, and of course, you know, I don't even know how Peter, I never asked him how he got the idea that this character is Vietnamese. Now, it turned out, I never knew this, but there was a bit of a Vietnamese enclave in Philly. And so that might have something to do with it, because Peter, he really knows that world, you know, in the East Coast and Philly and Jersey. And so that was a a very refreshing thing for me, being a father as well. And also, Peter was really clued into, you know, this whole sort of immigrant, Vietnamese immigrant thing, you know, with the mother and the history. And essentially, they were just trying to get a piece of the American dream, if you will, on the wrong side of the track, but, you know, managed to make something out of themselves, putting food on the table. And, you know, not to glorify these kind of people, but for me, that's sort of how it was written, how I approached it. And that was the refreshing part. I actually, you know, my wife, she doesn't even watch anything I do. She doesn't watch Warrior. It took me forever. She finally like watched one or two episodes of Warrior that I directed. Then she, okay, I'm going to watch it. And so with Dope Thief, like you were saying, you know, you know, I'll watch one episode with you. So she ended up watching the whole thing. And the first thing she said to me was, you know, this is like the coolest and the most refreshing Vietnamese American male character I've ever seen on screen.
Well, you know, it's great. It's great because, you know, you have been somewhat of a trendsetter, you know, a role model, if you may say, you know, because I know you were born and you were in Vietnam. Your parents were both entertainers. And then you left when you were 13 or, you know, and you end up in America.
11, yeah, 11.
So when you were young, though, because your parents were actors and, you know, were you surrounded by the arts as a kid? Did you start getting an interest very early that you said, I want to follow mom and dad's footsteps?
On the contrary, Steve, no. I remember clearly that I used to hate it. You know, my father, one of the many things that he was doing, he was producing and directing like a kids show, TV kids show type of thing where kids would perform and do skits. And there were some wonderful young performers. And he always tried to put me in it, you know. And now I would always be hiding behind like the other kids. I was very shy, very introverted. And he used to yell at me, you know, get in the front. What are you hiding back there for? And I never... It never impressed me. I never had a desire to act. However, as early as 9 years old, I remember I wanted to make movies because my dad and my mom used to drop me and my brother off, you know, at the local cinema. And we would watch, you know, these Run, Run, Shaw, Golden Harvest, Hong Kong films that was sort of really quite popular back then. Certainly in Vietnam, and watching these films, I remember I was so in awe of it all, and I remember thinking, this is what I want to do. Now, of course, back then, I didn't know, and eventually I found out, you know, there are producers and directors and writers and all of these people that would make movies, and I knew that I would be a director-producer one day. That's what I set out to do, and acting was just something I just fell into, which I eventually love and still love doing. But acting was never, I mean, if you tell me, you know, to get in front of the camera back then, it was just not something I would do. But through acting and being on set and being on three or four series, that was the greatest film school I could possibly have. You know, I would follow these directors around and learn from them, and then eventually started directing and producing. But that was, you know, to answer your question, no. And even there was a point in my life, you know, my father passed away 10 years ago, and I had a pretty typical father and son relationship for the Asian culture. Don't talk much, you know. My father, one of the old school guy, very loving, put food on the table, but don't talk much. And when he found out that you know, they wanted me to become an engineer, Steve. And like I said, I knew that wasn't going to happen because during high school, I was already scheming how I was going to be able to go to film school, knowing my father would be against it. And then I managed to dupe them into thinking, letting me move to California saying that there was a great engineering school there. And then, of course, a couple of years later, I couldn't live with a lie anymore. So I told him the truth. And so for three, almost 4 years, you know, we didn't speak at all. And it was one of those very dramatic things. Like, on the phone, my dad is like, you know, you're not my son anymore. And that was his exact words, and hung up the phone and refused to speak with me for 3 or 4 years. But yeah, it's a long answer to your question, but that's kind of like the, you know, the back story of that.
Well, it's funny. It's just not Asian fathers. My dad was a very WASPy father, and, you know, was in World War II. Same thing. You don't talk, and you don't communicate. And you knew you were loved, but you just never communicate. You never say I love you. But late, and as you're right, as they get older, then they start opening up more, because they go. So I went through the same thing, because my father passed away 11 years ago. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Now, did you in the last when did you start to talk to each other?
My dad, I was living in L.A. and they came out to see the Rose Bowl. My dad was in D-Day. And he never talked about it, but he actually brought an article of this paper that wrote up his boat, and he was mentioned because he got a Purple Heart. And that was the first time he really talked about it, that he opened up. I mean, he was always, you know, like when I did comedy, you know, when I did stand-up comedy, he'd come to the shows with my mom. But that's the first time he really just talked on a level of just not that, you know how it is, like the father, son. So mm-hmm. That was probably 25 years ago, 20 years ago. It wasn't that long ago that we actually opened up.
Yeah, you know, the reason I ask is, for me, it was the last 5 years of my dad's life. You know, we started. I don't remember the actual mechanism that started it, but we started to really bond and talk, you know, as man to man. And my father changed a lot too towards the end of his life, and that was some of the greatest, you know, memories, and he started giving me advice, not in a very obvious way, but a lot of things he said really stuck with me, you know, and in a lot of ways, he's kind of apologized, you know, that men of that generation, and essentially he said, look, you know, it's not that I don't support, you know, you going after your dream, but, you know, you got to understand where I was coming from. You know, we're refugees, you know, we're second class citizens. If you were in Vietnam, I would totally be supported and can tremendously help you in this very tough journey that you picked. But you haven't picked it in a country where, you know, you're not the majority. And I feared, you know, that you would have a lot of heartbreaks. And so that was his way of amending, you know, all those years that he disapproved of what I chose.
Well, you've done very well. And now, when you moved to L.A., how long until you got cast on 21 John Street? What was your when you decided to go into really acting? How long did it take you? Because, you know, it was early in your career, right?
Yeah, very early on. I mean, luck has been on my side, you know. Thank God. I came out in 1980, did the typical thing, you know, waiting on tables. Now, again, mind you, I didn't come out to be an actor, so I came out and applied for UCLA Film School, thinking that I got a pretty good shot at it, and then I got rejected. But I was already, like, making short films. Back in the day, Steve, you know, it was the actual Super 8 millimeter film that you splice with tape, and you know, you actually feel it and just loving it. You know, days in the editing room, I would just pass out and wake up and keep going. So I was doing that, and so I was using actors, you know, from the theater departments and all of that. And one of the actors had an agent, a sweet woman, Miriam Baum, and she kept coming to me, you know, because I would go to the acting classes where some of these actors were at. Not to learn acting, but I wanted to see if I could learn something about actors and acting so I could effectively, you know, direct actors or communicate with them. And so she always like, you know, I don't have anyone your type, and you know, you should be an actor. You should consider being an actor. And I was like, Miriam, no. You know, I can't. I don't want to do that. And, but, you know, fate has a way of steering you in certain directions. And my friend Leon, you know, he was like, one of the clients is like, hey, man, you know, you got a year. You're waiting around to reapply next year to UCLA. So during this year, you know, what you might as well try it. You can make a lot of money doing commercials. And so I tried it, and just like I thought, I wasn't cut out for it. It was terrible, you know. And you know, commercial acting, you got to be really, you got to be out there and strong personality, and which I didn't have. And somehow I landed my first gig, Steve, you know. And Miriam, you know, they were looking for somebody to guest star on a two-part Magnum PI. The original Magnum PI. And, you know, you got to remember, like, back then, I didn't know what SAG stands for. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what a resume is, nor do I care. So apparently they were looking for a young actor to play this Cambodian freedom fighter in this two-parter lead guest spot. Miriam sent my picture in, and they wanted to see me. Apparently they haven't found anybody they liked, and I remember it was a Friday afternoon, because I used to hang out at her office a lot and help her, you know, staple back then you staple headshots yeah. with resume and, you know, and helping her, you know, just sort of housekeeping in the office, she said, oh, you know, these people, Universal wants to see you for the show Magnum. And I'm like, what do you mean see me? Well, just go down there, you know, and here's some of the sides. And I didn't even know what sides were, right? So they handed me like 5 or 6 pages of stuff. I was scared out of my mind. I went down there. There was a room full of people, and I'm like, "Oh, you can read for us." And I'm reading whatever I get there. As soon as I'm done, I just want to run out of the room. You know, I was just so embarrassed. And the showrunner, Ruben Leader. Dustin, sit down, you know. And so he started talking to me, you know, what are you doing and where are you from? You're from Vietnam, blah, 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 blah. Are you SAG? No. Have you ever acted before? No. Okay, so I leave the office. I go back to Miriam's office. As soon as I walked in, she said, you're leaving Monday for Hawaii. And now, Steve, you got to remember this. I'm thinking, first of all, I didn't even know it was a lead guest star. I thought it was like maybe like a bit part. You know, one day shoot or whatever. Now, you know, it's like, you're going to be in Hawaii for a month. It's a two-parter. You're leaving Monday. And that's how I got my first gig. You know, I got tapped hardly. Scared out of my mind every single day on the set. Because, you know, for sure I was going to be fired. Most amazing group of people, Steve, to this day. Really generous. Tom Selleck was an amazing, classy example of how to be, you know, when you're the number one on the call sheet, star of the show. Now, you know, he was at the top of,
I remember, the biggest.
I mean, we were out, anywhere we were shooting outdoor, there was a barricade of people wanted to see Tom. And he would actually get up and walk across the street and chat with a few people, signing autographs and all that. But amazing experience. That's how I got started. And then Jump Street came shortly after. I did Magnum in 84. After that, I did a soap opera, General Hospital, for a year. That's when I realized I better take this seriously, because somehow, if I keep getting these jobs, I got to really study, and which I started doing. Then fell in love with it. And not so much of, oh, I'm going to be an actor now. But what I found was it fixed a lot of problems that I don't know about fixing it, but, you know, I realized a lot of things, how I behave a certain way and why I was introverted, and certain things that certain emotional blockage I would have, you know, from my childhood. And so all of that I thought was just tremendously helpful and fascinating. And then I landed 21 Jump Street, and that was in 1986.
You know, funny thing about Jump Street is, because I graduated college in 86. And so it was, you know, we followed it. You know, we followed the shows and, you know, and it was, I mean, when you look back, it was pop culture, man. I mean, like, that was, everyone knows Jump Street. So was it hard? I mean, who were you going up against for the part? Because like we said, you were the one of the first Asian American leads. And then, you know, I read an article where they write, you weren't an Asian American cop. You were a cop who was Asian American. It was different. It was a different type of acting. But when you went up for that, was it, did they say, because you know how Hollywood is, everyone laughs. It says, you know, you're looking for this. I did a Calvin Harris video. And I got the role as, I got the role as creepy guy. So yeah, I look at the breakdown. It says creepy guy. My agent calls me. I go, oh great. You know, you feel good about yourself, and you go, I get cast as creepy guy. But what do you remember what the breakdown said for Harry Truman Aoki?
I never actually read the breakdown, but Miriam, my agent, told me. Now you got to remember, you know, everyone knows 21 Jump Street is a big hit show. When it came out, or when it was first conceived and went into production, it was an underdog, right? So you got this wannabe Fox network that everyone was actually snickering about. Oh, these guys, they think they're going to be the fourth network. Married with Children was the only show they had. And then there was 21 Jump Street. Those are the two things that they were gonna, that was gonna launch their network, right? If at all. 21 Jump Street, well, back then it was called Jump Street Chapel. And we knew that we were gonna do the pilot and 13 episodes, which is very rare. Back then you only do the pilot and then you wait and see. But because, you know, they had no shows.
Right.
So what the hell, we'll give them 13. So we have something to put on the air. So now Patrick Hasberg, the show writer and runner, Stephen Cannell too, wonderful man, but Patrick Hasberg was really the creative force behind it. It was never really written as an Asian American character. Now I remember I walked into the room for the audition, my first audition. There were like black actors, there were Latino actors, there was Asian actors, there was everybody. And the idea was it was going to be a multicultural type of show, right? Quite ahead of its time. And diverse, what's the word, diversity. So they knew it was going to be that kind of a thing, but I don't think it was ever set as an Asian American. So when I got the show, I think as I was narrowing down, you know, to finally go to network approval and all of that, and when we shot the pilot, it became Harry Aoki, but because of that, you said something earlier about it's a cop that happens to be Asian American versus Asian American who happens to be a cop. That's, I think, where the show really stood out and was ahead of its time. And I think you're right. At the time, I don't think there was an Asian American lead in a network TV show. And because of that, any of the characters, you know, can actually be played by any one of us at any given week. Let's say if I was sick and Johnny had to step in to fill in that part, or Peter, and vice versa. You know, we could pretty much rotate and do it, and that was the beauty of it. And yet they still retain, you know, a certain amount of Asian American elements. And then, of course, when they found out that I was Vietnamese, you know, Patrick approached me about, he found out about my backstory, escaping Vietnam, you know, in my real life. And they said, oh, I think it's a wonderful story, and you know, maybe we can incorporate it and change Harry Aoki. Because you're Vietnamese, you know, we should make him Vietnamese. And I said to Patrick, I said, no, Patrick, you know, I said, you don't get it, man. You know, I don't want that. You know, thank you, but I'm an actor, man. The last thing I want to, if I just play Vietnamese American, I would never work after the show, you know. And why can't I play Japanese American? I mean, obviously, if it was a period piece, that requires me to speak, you know, fluent Japanese or whatever, and that's different. But I mean, Mexican actors can play Puerto Rican and play Italian and vice versa and all of that. And they just kept at it. And finally, he said, "Well, look, let me pitch you how we're going to do it." And it sounded wonderful. And I gave in on it. And we ended up making that episode, Christmas in Saigon, which, from what I've been told, is one of the favorite episodes for people. But yeah, back then, like I said, and then you realize, the only American, Asian American on primetime TV, and the show became a huge runaway hit, which we never expected it. But that's really when it landed. But before that, it was just, man, I'm just so happy I got this gig, and it's a great gig. 13 episodes became 22 for the first season, which was, we were like jumping for joy, and then the second season, we didn't even know we were a hit because, we were shooting in Vancouver, Canada, Steve, back then. There was a We're one of the first TV shows to shoot there. Of course, now it's North Hollywood, and the Canadians didn't get the show the first couple of years up there. So we didn't, we're up there 9 months out of the year. And so when we found out there was a hit during the second season when they had us do our first personal appearance at the Sherman Oaks Galleria. They flew us back on the weekend to make an appearance there, and that's when we found out. It was a surreal experience, Steve. There were just thousands of girls and fans, and it's just surreal, man.
That happens. It's funny because I talked to Anson Williams, who played Potsy on Happy Days, and he said they would do these things, and like thousands of people would show up. And and as you said, you're in Vancouver, so you're not, and they're not seeing it up there, so they probably just think it's a production. But I got to ask you, it must have been great because, as I said, I'm an '80s guy, and the fashion. You guys were getting great Hollywood threads, and you were dressed, and your hair always changed. Everyone had a different look. How great was that, though? When you're a younger guy, and all of a sudden you wear the coolest clothes, and then you end up with magazines. Did you like the '80s clothes? Because I loved the old shoulder pads and the leather jacket with the thing. Were you a fan of that '80s style, or were you like, I don't like this?
No, I was. I'm a fan of. I guess let's use the word fashion. I've always had a sense of an appreciation for fine clothing. Whatever that happens to be, and so I already have that love, and then to be able to wear these really cool clothes, and in the '80s, I mean that was the thing. The shoulder pads, the leather jackets, and so I loved it. And to be able to play a character, an Asian character that was in Long Duk Dong, all in 16 candles. Now this is not a shot at the actor Geddy Watanabe, who I'm not friendly with, but I know him and he knows me, and I like him a lot. But you know what I'm saying. So for me back then, it was like, oh no, this is a cool character. Get to wear all these cool clothes and all of that, and I loved it. Miami Vice was also another, benchmark for beautiful clothes. So yeah, I ate it up. I loved all of it, and I think, I can't speak for the rest, but for me, but we were very close, by the way. But you're at that age, and first of all, I think I was blessed enough to have enough sense in me to realize how lucky I was. And I had enough sense in me to realize this is not going to last forever. So really enjoy it. Now, I wasn't out doing drugs and, tearing up hotel rooms and getting drunk and all of that in public, but I was really appreciating every minute of it, because I knew it wouldn't last.
Now, how do you keep grounded, though? I know you can say you know it's not going to last, and you appreciate it, but let's be honest. We're at a young age. I think you're a year older than me. So, that was 87 and 88 when it started becoming big. You're 23, 24, or however old.
Yep.
How do you stay grounded? Because I don't care what, you know, we can say, we know it's not going to last. But all of a sudden, anywhere you go in America, not in Canada, anywhere you go, people are recognizing you. You know, you guys, I mean, young people. And it's a matter of, you're probably getting, you know, better treatment at restaurants, stuff like that, getting free food or whatever, you know, it happens, people coming up. So how do you keep grounded? Was it because of the way you grew up? Because a lot of people, you know, just, you know, with Johnny was hanging at the Viper Room and stuff like that. I mean, how did you stay grounded? Because it must be very hard, because it has to be tempting. Plus, you're making cash. You're on a show. You got money in your pocket. So how did you, why do you think you stayed grounded?
I think I would have to venture to say because, you know, I grew up with nothing. That doesn't necessarily keep you in line, but it helps a lot. You know, there are a lot of things I think about, even to this day. You know, I think about, I mean, I don't want to be sappy about it, but, you know, occasionally when I'm sitting having a really beautiful meal, you know, and sometimes I go for great, you know, like sushi, beautiful sushi meal with my wife or whatever. Or even back then, you know, a nice meal can cost $200, $300 easy, you know, if you splurge. And occasionally I can't help but think about the time when I was on this ship, you know, during the escape of Vietnam, where we were just part of thousands of people, a freight ship, you know, in these containers and just on the bare floor. And I remember they were handing out, I kid you not, a piece of Wonder Bread, you know, that square piece of bread. You know, we're a family of four, right? My brother and mom, dad, and we would have that piece of bread and we were split in four, and an orange. And I think about that sometimes, you know, especially when I'm having a terrific meal. I think about that. Look, I mean, I'm a young guy, like you said. I've always wanted a new car, you know. I bought my first car.
What'd you get?
Not only bought my first new car, but, you know, growing up and watching James Bond movies, I remember that he had a Lotus, a white Lotus that turned to a submarine. I don't know if you remember, but anyway, so I went now and bought a Lotus, and enjoyed it because I was also quite a racer. You know, I went to racing school and loved driving a fine piece of machine. But after a couple of months, to be honest with you, Steve, I realized it wasn't the right thing for me because I used to be so embarrassed, and it was red. You know, I would actually park in a far away before I walk up to a restaurant or to a function or something instead of pulling up to valet parking because I was kind of embarrassed to be seen with such a bright red Lotus car. I know it sounds weird and paradoxical, but I keep grounded like that, you know. And I remember too, you know, I remember, man, you know, this guy was on the cover of the magazine, you know, all over the place, and where is he now? I mean, the people that came before me. And so you think about that, you know, you pay attention. It's amazing, you know, your face could be, somebody's face could be plastered everywhere, and then a few years later, you never see them again. You know, where do they go, right? And then somebody else would be the next thing, and it's rare that you have a Tom Cruise that can last 30, 40 years.
It is. Now, what do you think about, what was it about 21 Jump Street that really hit the pulse of people? Because, you know, it's a show, and I mean, it was, as I said, it was very involved in pop culture. You're all good-looking people. You know, you're dressed cool. It's an idea, oh, well, they're in a high school. You know, it's cool, you know. But what do you think it is? Do you think it was because of our 80s mindset that we just wanted something different? It was a diverse cast. You look good. I mean, and there was good storylines. What do you think, why was it a hit? Because you always wonder, you know, and an actor is around it. Sometimes you probably never even know why it's a hit. you know, I know people have been in movies that are hit and they go, oh my God, it was an awful movie. But there's, what do you think, what struck the nerve to make it a successful show with 21 Jump Street? And once again, you said you were on Fox. Who the hell is Fox, you know? Married with Children, that's it.
We used to get, back in the day, literally bags and bags of fan mail sent to our house, you know, in this case to our agency, from all over the world. And that's how big this show was, at least to me, the only thing I've ever experienced. And almost every one of the fans would tell us, and this is why this show was a huge success. It was the first show ever to address teens, young people, as human beings with challenges, conflicts of morale, making the right choice. Am I doing the right thing? Am I enough? You know, why am I not enough? No one ever addressed that in a entertainment format. And Jump Street was the first to do it in a, I dare say, not too preachy. I mean, we used to have those public service announcement at the end of the show, you know, one would be about, call the suicide hotline if you're not feeling good, or you know, the drug dependent hotline. So these PSA were, well, we did them, and they were a little bit preachy, but more in a spirit of very fun and helpful. But the show, the heart of the show, and I think it won a lot of the hearts of the young people, were they felt for the first time, not only was it an entertaining show and a kind of a cool show to look at in terms of like eye candy factor, it was really treating them as human beings and acknowledging how difficult it is to go through high school or to become an adult, on the journey of becoming an adult. That was the secret of the show.
And it's true, you're right, because no one did. That's so funny that, you know, looking back at it now, you're right. And it was a big hit. Now, after, it was supposed to get canceled for season 4, right?
Yeah, I believe. It's been a long time, because at that time I decided to leave the show, and so did Johnny. So I don't know if it was canceled. I don't think it was canceled, because I remember when I made the decision to leave the show, my agent thought I was crazy and stupid, and they only think that because there was a coming season that we were about to renegotiate or whatever, right? And I opted out.
Why?
At that time, and things are only relevant to the moment that you're making these decisions, I felt like I had hit a ceiling with the show in terms of the character and what the show is capable of doing, and I suspect that it wasn't going to be able to continue doing what it used to do. We also had a couple of changes with the showrunner. Patrick Hasberg was no longer our showrunner. He had moved on to other things. New showrunners were kind of coming and going. So I felt that the show was starting to decline. And I say that with respect. But personally, I felt stifled. It was a lot of confusion going on. I didn't want to be ungrateful, you know. And everyone thought I was ungrateful to want to not come back for another season. I knew how difficult it is for actors, and I knew I probably would go without working for a while, you know. But I was single. I saved a lot of money, made a lot of money, and I was pretty comfortable with money. You know, I lived quite simple relative to most people in that position, and I was like, I'm okay. If I couldn't work for a couple of years or so, I'd be more than okay. And that's why I now, Is it the right thing? No one knows, right? At that time, it felt right. I've lost a couple of nights of sleep over it because people were like, "Yeah, you better rethink. You know, you got to think it over. This is not. I don't think it's the right thing to do." And it wasn't like, "Oh, I want to do feature films." It wasn't that. I just felt like I was a bit stifled, and you just leap in, you make that decision, you know, for better or for worse. And you know, Steve, I did not work for a couple of years, like I predicted it, because back then, again, the more you talk about it, the more you realize how rare 21 Jump Street and my character, my involvement in it was. It wasn't like now when there's a lot more opportunities for Asian American performers in various formats. And again, you know, these days there's more things being made because of the streaming platforms and et cetera and et cetera. And so, but that's why I think I've always go back to the thing about, you know, listening to your heart. You might not understand exactly the details, but your heart tells you this is the thing to do.
Well, you know, also, if you had stayed, you may have ended up going back to Vietnam and started directing. It may have changed your whole life. You may have sat there and said, "Oh, well, then all of a sudden you get a spinoff." And then you don't, you know. And I know you went on and you were on VIP and, you know, a bunch of guests on shows. But what drove your move back to Vietnam? And was it to direct? I want to know how you ended up getting back there, because I did not know about that. And I read about it a while ago. And I was like, after I saw you on the show, I was like, yeah, oh, you know, I remember all this stuff. And then I saw, you know, that you went and you got to what your dream was as a kid. You wanted to direct. So what made you decide? Did you get an offer to go to Vietnam, or what happened?
I did. And you're absolutely right, Steve. You know, there are so many probabilities in that's going on that, you know, there's a Steve and a Justin sitting here talking to each other right now. But at 9 o'clock, you know, or even yesterday, if I had made a decision not to participate in this podcast, or you made a decision not to invite me, that would have been a different Steve and a different Dustin, right? So there's all these probabilities that you can tap into. And if I didn't stop 21 Jump Street, yes, for sure, I wouldn't have done all the other things that lead up to now. And Vietnam was one of those things that came that the universe brought to me, where I had always harbored this desire to act in my mother's tongue. And I was also very curious through the years what Vietnam is like since I left as a child, and I had no idea. And so this offer came for a movie called The Rebel, Vietnamese language film. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. I'm quite proud of it. It was the first Vietnamese film to be acquired by the Hollywood studio, the Weinstein Company, to be exact. It's about the French colonization of Vietnam and how the rebels rises up. Action drama. So these filmmakers from Vietnam sent me this script, and I read it. And I said, "Oh, you know, this is a really wonderful story." And I could really feel the patriotism and the spirit of the Vietnamese people. And I said to them, I said, "I would do this if I get to play the villain." Because that's the other thing. I always want to play the villain. And back then, I would never get cast as the villain. You know, I didn't have that face of a villain, a typical villain. And that's what brought me to, you know, and they're like, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Yeah, let me do it." And went to Vietnam, went from north to south, shot this film. Amazing experience, amazing homecoming. Little did I know, the film became a huge blockbuster and cemented, you know, my name and the filmmakers and everybody to Vietnam pop culture. And so I got invited to do another movie the following year, and meeting some key people in the industry there, which is very small at the time and still is now. And everyone was like, "You know, you should come back and be a part of this community and take what you've learned overseas. And at that time, I was, again, I hit a glass ceiling. You know, I actually had quit acting, Steve, because I felt like I wasn't going anywhere. And again, the other half was like, I felt guilty that I felt that way because relatively, compared to my peers, I had a good, you know. And but anyway, I was at a place, I quit acting. I was very disillusioned about it. And so when I went to Vietnam, I thought, okay, you know, let's maybe the universe is telling you something here. So I leaped in, I left everything. I went to Vietnam and you know, by this time the rebel had made me become quite a name there. And I started making some wonderful films, opened my company there and started producing, directing, telling wonderful stories. I made films there that were huge blockbusters. I made films there that have won some of the highest cinematic awards there. I made films that flopped as well, all kinds of stuff. But having a great time, you know, living there, met my wife there, you know, had my first two girls. Just really living the dream, you know.
Well, you know, you had mentioned
that's how it happened.
We had mentioned earlier that, you know, you went to the best film school being on set with like 21 Jump Street. And I always think that when you started directing, how much of an advantage do you think you had? Because I'm sure in your career, you've worked with shitty directors and you sit there and go, oh, because I don't care. You've had a long career. You've worked with shitty directors and you sit there and you probably know why they're shitty. And so you probably sit in your mind that you want to direct, said, I would never do it like that. How important was it that you had learned so much in the crap when you finally got a chance to start directing?
First of all, what I'm about to say is not a knock to film schools at all. And I want to make that clear because somebody's listening and think I'm not saying that. But I tell you, I am a true believer and I subscribe to you know, the philosophy, someone said, was it Bruce Lee? Somebody said, you cannot learn how to swim on dry land. You know, you can learn all the strokes and all of that. But the minute they throw you in the water, you know, you start taking in water and it's a whole different game. And learning on a film set is the best you could possibly learn, bar none, you know, because it's real world, and you're drowning. You know, you see crisis happening every day. So let's say you're a director, you got to solve so many things in a single day. You got to be juggling things. You got to manage the actors. You got to manage the visual, and so it's the best learning. And then again, you're dealing. You know, in my case, I was shadowing so many different directors, and you get to see how many different ways people are working, things that they did that you felt were great and informative and creative, and some people did things that you go, wow, you know, I don't get why they're doing that. But you expose, you know, to this amazing different ways of working, and so it's extremely important for me. And I remember thinking, man, I hit the jackpot. You know, this is forget film school. I mean, this is it. And so when I started directing, I was very confident, not in a arrogant way, but I felt I was ready. You know, I was really ready. Now, what I wasn't ready for is the way filmmaking is done in Vietnam, right? Back, especially back then. You know, this was in 2007. And what I mean by that is, you know, in America, they want you to make a nice phone, and it's going to cost, to make something of this quality, it says it costs you $10. They're asking you to do the same thing in Vietnam, but they only give you like $4 to do it. so you get the picture, right? So all of a sudden you're like, okay, now it's a whole other thing, right? But from that you learn. Right? That's another educational journey that I wouldn't trade for anything. I don't make films anymore, and I don't see myself doing it anymore now that I'm back in the States, but those 10, 11 years working over there, I tell you, there's no other school that's going to teach me what I've learned over there.
Now, what made you leave there? Because you went there, and you became, once again, it's like the second part of your career. You know, you were big here, and then you go there, you end up being big there, because this, just like 21 Jump Street, you know it was going to be a hit, it became big. Mm-hmm. The movie Rebel became big. What made you move back to the States?
I never thought I would go back to the States, Steve. You know, I was so happy there. And again, this is, you know, the universe have funny ways of steering you in certain directions. And so I got a call one day from an old friend, Justin Lin, who you might know. He's the guy that really built the Fast and Furious franchise. You know, arguably the first Asian American, A-list Asian American actors, I mean, directors in Hollywood, at least when he started out. And I acted in a film for him years ago, and we sort of stayed in touch, and then I disappeared, and he tracked me down, and he's like, what the hell are you doing in Vietnam? What's going on? Can I see some of the films you're making? And I put English subs on all of the films I do over there. So very supportive. Man, you know, I'm happy you're finally doing what you love, directing over there. And then the next call I got from him was, hey, you know, I'm about to do this show called Warrior for HBO. And I wrote a nice part for you. And I'd love for you to join me. And I was in the middle of directing a film in Vietnam at the time, Steve. And I said to Justin, I said, man, I said, listen, I got a great life here now. You know, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I'm directing. My kids are here. I'm not sure if I got the bandwidth to do this. And you know, because he's such a generous guy and wonderful guy, you know, he said to me, he said, you are a director. You know, I see that in you. But this is a wonderful project. And I'd love for you to join me. You know, and maybe as they get to know you, you know, HBO and all of that, maybe we can get you to direct eventually. You know, he said, I can't promise it, but think about that. And so I said, look, you know, wait for me. Let me finish this film. I don't know if you saw Warrior, but I joined him towards the end of the first season. And by the end of the first season, they let me direct season 2 and 3, besides acting in it. And so that was my return, if you will. And again, I, you know, I was very realistic. Amazing experience, by the way, Warrior. Oh, my God. You know, people who talk to me, they probably think, oh, he say that about all his projects. And I do, because I've been so lucky that all the series I've worked on, people have just been amazing. You know, no prima donnas, none of that. And Warrior was one of those experiences. And so that was how I started directing stateside. And then other work just started coming, you know, and it was sort of like this welcome back to my adopted land, country. You know, I did a couple of movies for Universal. I did this wonderful other film 2 years ago for Barbara Broccoli and Thunder Road, you know, the people who did John Wick. A drama, you know, ended up winning the top prize at Sundance. And I got probably some of the best reviews of my life as an actor. And then Dope Thief came. I mean, just one thing after another. And so it's just been a wonderful return, if you will, and that's how I came back. I never planned to.
Now, why did you choose Hawaii? Because, you know, I left L.A. 8 years ago, and I'm glad. I was out there for 18 years, and L.A. just beats the shit out of you. I'm not, you know how to, and you were, you know, you had a successful career, and it probably still gets, it wears you down. But why did you pick Hawaii? Because I've noticed a lot of actors. I know a lot of actors who have left L.A. I know like Reed Diamond and Xander Berkeley. They all moved to Maine. You know, the people are moving here. People moving to New Orleans. Why did you pick Hawaii?
Well, I was had three things that I had to check off, right? Now, mind you, I grew up, like, you know, I grew up in Southern California and lived there for a long time, and very fond of, I mean, you can't, you know, there's a reason why everyone go to California. Southern California, the weather's great and all of that. And of course, if you're in the entertainment industry, but it's not the same California that I grew up with. I realized when I came back to it from Vietnam. And so I was thinking of, I could see the state was sort of deteriorating in all aspects. And I never really care for the lifestyle there. And now that I have kids, very young kids, certainly not a place I want to raise my children. And my wife, who's from Vietnam, you know, she shivers whenever it gets below 60 degrees. So if we're not going to live in California, there aren't a whole lot of other options, right? I'm not going to live in Florida. I'm not going to live in Texas. I love Arizona, but not the greatest place to raise children. So there were three things. So the weather, and at that time during COVID, there was this sudden anti-Asian hate violence that was happening. I don't know if you were aware of that, East Coast, but certainly the West Coast. And you know, even for me, growing up in America, I've never seen that type of violence associated with, you know, racism with Asian people. So my wife was very scared. And so the thing that is a safe environment where we don't feel that. And I don't know why I didn't think of Hawaii, but I had a couple of friends living there, and we were looking everywhere, you know, mind you. At one point, we almost moved to North Carolina, oddly enough. But so, again, Steve, this is how the universe works. I got a call. My agent calls me. He said, "Hey, you know the show NCSI?" I said, "Well, I know of it. I don't watch it. You know, it's a huge franchise." So, well, they're doing, you know, the Hawaiian version of it, and they would like you to come do a guest spot. And I was like, "Oh, Hawaii, okay." But that's how, you know, I haven't been there in a long time. Now, this is how it worked. What was my first job? Magnum PI. I remember when I landed in Hawaii and when I was doing that job, I remember saying to myself, "One day I'm going to live here." Years later, right? So now I'm going back to Hawaii doing this NCSI job. I remember I was coming in, I'm looking at the amazing landscape of just... The minute I landed on the way to the hotel, I called my wife, you know, I said, "Hawaii." And she has been there on her own years ago, you know, it checked everything for us. And that's immediately I got a realtor to start looking around. It took a while, you know, for us to work out the logistics and a couple of years. But the best decisions I've ever made, Steve, moving here and raising my children here. And only this last year that I've been able to spend quite a bit of time here, because when we moved here, I was still in South Africa doing warrior and working, and was in Budapest. Basically, I worked all over the world, and not until I finished Dope Thief did I get a chance to really settle in here with my family and really enjoyed it. But that's how Hawaii came about.
It's weird how life ends, starts. It's weird things that happen. I got two more questions. One, tell me a good memory or a crazy time on the set of 21 Jump Street, or an experience from that show. Because I'm just thinking, you guys were rock stars. I mean, what was some of this? I mean, how were you swarmed? Just tell me a crazy story from that time.
Well, this is my closest experience to being a star, you know? And it's crazy. Now, before this incident I'm about to tell you happened, the show's already hit, and yeah, we know we know we're cool, you know, I mean, like, in the sense where we're definitely famous and the show is at the top of it. But not until I went, I remember I took my girlfriend at that time. We went to, I don't know how we ended up in Washington, D.C. It could have been some function. I think we got a chance to visit the White House or something like that. But so we were doing our tourist thing, you know, and it was summertime. I remember we were at Lincoln Center and doing the whole thing, Aerospace Museum. And all of a sudden, we had just arrived, and it was summer, so all the kids are out of school. And there's like apparently busloads of students and all of that also doing what we're doing, like, you know, seeing Washington, D.C. There must have been close to 1,000 young people. Because I just heard this scream, right? I mean, the volume, I remember, it startled me and my girlfriend. We looked and they were massive and running towards me because they had spotted me. And I was like, you know, it's like one of those POV shots. You just see bodies coming at you, running and screaming. And I remember, just instinctively, I just grabbed my girlfriend's hand. We turned and ran for the door. As that, you know, and I remember afterwards, we ended up, most of the trip, we couldn't go anywhere. But the point I'm saying, that was the craziest experience, because I remember thinking, even though I've already been, you know, famous and signing autographs and people coming up, but that particular day was crazy. And I remember thinking, this is what it must feel like for a fraction of it. Elvis Presley, Michael Jackson, when they step on stage, you know, something, Steve, about the volume of teenage girls, you know, with their falsetto vibrate. I mean, coming, you literally can feel it on your body, the waves of sound. It's a weird thing. It's really a weird thing. That's probably the craziest experience I've ever experienced.
And one final question. I always ask my guests this. It can be personal. It can be professional. It can be both. You know, you can tell me one of a few. But looking back at your career and your life, what are a few things or just one thing that really make you proud? Like when you sit and you look, you reflect, because we're getting older now. We reflect, you mm-hmm. know, about our lives. What makes you proud?
Man, it's well, a couple of things come to mind, but I think the thing that I'm most proud of, certainly since I've had my children too, and that's the biggest cliche, you know, everyone talks about how when you have children, they change you tremendously. And I'm the most proud, I think, for me, that the day I realized how valuable time is, and specifically how valuable my time is. And this might come out weird, but it's the best thing that could happen to me when I realized that. And that's why, if I can say I'm proud of something, because what it done for me is it had taught me not to be so blasé with my time, because I think of all the times I've given my time away. Hey, let's get together for coffee and catch up, you know, somebody not necessarily is a friend, but you know, you end up going to coffee or whatever, that's an hour or two of your life right there you don't get back. And I'm not saying I'm too good for them or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But you think about, okay, that's time you don't get back, right? So that 2 hours I could be with my children, or I could be with my wife, or I could be with my best friend. You get the idea. So you start to really manage your time, and then you start to realize we're all chasing after money, and that's fine. We need it, you know? But that's not the most valuable commodity. It's, you can always make more money, right, as long as you have your health. But man, you cannot make more time, right? I haven't figured out how to do it yet, have you, Steve?
I haven't, man. I would like to.
Right. So that realization again, it might sound philosophical and new agey or whatever the heck it might sound like, but if you really ponder about it, it is so true how we are so blasé. You know, we work hard, we save our money, but we're so blasé about how we manage our time. And so I'm very proud that and feel blessed that I had that realization. And because of that, you know, I truly feel I have a pretty happy life.
Well, that was awesome, man. Yes, it's true, true. You know, I really want to thank you for coming on today. This was great. Now, I'm glad I reached out to your guy, and I just want to thank Dope Thief. And people, I'm telling you, man, if you have Apple TV, you got to be watching Dope Thief, as I said. And you know, you may think, guys, you may not think it's right for your, you know, your woman. You know, my wife is a big brother junkie, but she sat down and she loved it because I was like, if you don't like it, and then we were four episodes in, I said, you still on the trip? She goes, yeah. So we're almost done. We're at six. We're going to finish it this weekend probably. And so people, yo, definitely go to IMDb and check out Dustin's great work. Go back and find all 21 Jump Streets. Also go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find over 1,045 episodes there. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.